Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, Blog Talk Radio audience. This is the Antique E Show, and I am your host, Leslie Gist. I like to start the show off by first explaining how the Antique E Show got its start. As an author of a book entitled The Gist of Freedom is Still Faith, I uncovered a lot of different facts about American history, Black history, in the course of my 10 years of researching. And I felt that this was the perfect forum to share with you and the Blog Talk audience everything that I learned and wrote about in my book, The Gist of Freedom is Still Faith. You can download my book for free on my website, thegist.freedom.com. You can go and download the book for free. That's how exciting it is for me to be able to share what I've learned. Everything that I uncovered are stories that I've never learned before in any classroom or on television. And these stories strengthened my faith with God. They also made me become a proud American. So much so, in 94 I went to Egypt, Africa, during my honeymoon. And nothing had an impact on me as much as the research of my book. So I thought that this forum, the Blog Talk Radio Show, would be the best place for me to introduce you to some of the scholars that I've met during my research and even after the research for the book, The Gist of Freedom is Still Faith. So tonight, we're going to let you listen to a very, very informative interview we had last night with Dr. Bethel. Dr. Bethel is a professor at Rutgers University. Dr. Bethel, along with another professor, started the Department of Africana over 40 years ago at Rutgers. He is a pioneer. Tonight, I'm only going to be able to share with you about 45 minutes worth of the interviews. The discussion was so intense that we spoke over an hour and a half, way past the expiration of the show. But we couldn't hang up because it was such a great interview. We continued on and we had the recordings, and so now we've edited the show and we've broken it up into several parts, and tonight we're just going to share with you what he talked about as far as Juneteenth and maybe some other related information about history. So sit back and enjoy listening to Dr. Bethel of Rutgers University, and just share this information with as many people as possible. Here we go. This is Dr. Bethel's intro. Dr. Bethel is a professor in the Africana Studies Department at Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey. He is entering his 36th year of service at Rutgers and completed his Doctorate of Education from the Graduate School of Education at Rutgers University in 1975. Dr. Bethel is the author of Africana, An Introduction and Study, Plainfield's African American, From Northern Slavery to Church Freedom, and a book titled Advancement Through Service, A History of the Frontiers. In 2003, Dr. Bethel was awarded Rutgers University's Warren I. Sussman Award for Teaching Excellence and was selected as a fellow of the Oxford Roundtable, Oxford University, England. He will join us tonight to offer his insights on this week's upcoming Black History holiday, Juneteenth. Thank you, Dr. Bethel, for being here, and thank you, Cinder, for providing his...
Hi, Dr. Bethel. How are you?
Fine.
Good.
great. Now, Dr. Bessel, I just wanted to tell you that while I teach at Fairleigh Dickinson University myself, I really have to admit that the story of Juneteenth is really not something that was in my Black history education. And one of my dear friends actually got married and specifically chose Juneteenth as a day for her wedding. And again, I didn't know why. So I am very interested, and I hope that our listeners are join me in just being interested in what is the significance of the holiday, the Black history holiday, Juneteenth.
Well, let me just inform the host that this is my 40th year at the university. Okay, but Juneteenth, as you know, the when the Emancipation Proclamation was signed by Abraham Lincoln in 1863 and disseminated around, especially to the southern region of the country, communication was not that great. You know, letters went out. People were informed, by messages being carried. Somehow or another, it didn't get to Texas. The slavery activity continued even beyond the Emancipation Proclamation and until it was the message they get through, and it came through in June during the third week. Because the people actually became free after, the signing of the Emancipation Proclamation, they began to celebrate that period to make known the fact that they were truly free. Now, you must, understand that one of the reasons why the Emancipation Proclamation document did not get clearly around because it was not really a universal document freeing slaves. It was area by area, county by county, state by state, and therefore the messages didn't get around as quickly and as clearly as it could have. And so people in Texas are happy, to continue to recognize, the freedom that took place after the Emancipation Proclamation, and they celebrate, and of course, there are celebrations around the country. It's still not a well-known and well-practiced holiday. It is recognized. It continues to be recognized as a holiday.
Well, thank you so much. Could you tell me, Dr. Bessel, what are some of the traditions and the rituals surrounding the celebrations for Juneteenth? And was Texas the only state that was left out of the news of the Emancipation Proclamation?
Well, of course, it was later than all of the other states, and this is the reason why, people took a special interest, those people in Texas took a special interest in celebrating because slavery continued to be legally practiced, even though there was an emancipation signed by President Abraham Lincoln. People celebrate this date with all kinds of programs, and there's a cookout. Some have family reunions, and it's celebrated in many different ways. Certain communities have have organized programs with speakers, and some have dinners with speakers. Cookouts seem to be it seems to be the practice, throughout Texas and wherever people recognize the holiday.
Well, Dr. Bessel, I'm interested to find out, are there any artifacts or any kind of, paintings or anything that would point today's interested black historian into seeing what Juneteenth looked like in that era, the Emancipation Proclamation era?
Well, there is material. It is sort of limited. We need more writing about it. There is some recognition given to it, I think, by I can't think of the museum out in the Midwest. I'm quite sure that, you know, I haven't seen a painting, but I understand there is some recognition of that. It is a practice that is just sort of recently, within the past decade, become known, and African Americans who practice the holiday are beginning to. They gather. There's not much information about it. You can get detailed information on the web, but it is a work to yet be clearly documented. In other words, we need a clear work written on Juneteenth, published, showing all the detail with personalities and all of the events that took place during that time. Which would, of course, involve some more detailed research. But as far as we are concerned, and now, it is still kind of new to us all. But there are many groups that celebrate it, and it still has not caught on as well as it should have.
Well, was it strictly a happy time, or were there any uprisings? I mean, were some of the slaves angered by the fact that, you know, other states had been emancipated for several months and there was this lag in getting the information to them? Did they feel somehow?
Well, of course, there was resentment and so on, but there wasn't really much that they could do because, you know, the military governors started to come into the picture. You know, there was complication with black codes coming into the picture during the Reconstruction period, and the transition from the slave period into a period into practices of free states and throughout the South, it was a very slow transitional process. It wasn't something that happened overnight, and of course. You know, they, like I guess many blacks who came out of slavery, you really couldn't amass a group of strong protests. They were just trying to make the transition, move into this the period. But they weren't yet completely free, and this was true throughout the South. Even after the Emancipation Proclamation, black codes came into the picture, and there was still a great deal of difficulty throughout the South with blacks adjusting to the American, the new federated state of things coming out of Confederation. So there wasn't a battle, physical resistance, but there was, of course, anger and adjustment. And eventually out of it, there was a celebration recognizing, you know, their freedom.
Sure. Now, I know that in states such as North Carolina, there may have been sharecropping that, you know, came out of slavery ending and then white landowners in turn needing to have their farms tended to by people that were familiar with the land. Mm-hmm. So did that occur also in Texas or
yes,
were other industries?
Because you have to realize that people who came out of slavery had the skills that they had were skills that they acquired you know, during the slave period. They weren't formally educated. They didn't just come out of freedom, I mean, out of slavery, and adjust to life with working skills. They continued to do the things that they knew how to do, and a good bit of their activity was relegated to the plant, you know, plantation practice. I mean, this was one of the problems during the Reconstruction period. You had a lot of people literally going back and into the fields, and there was ruthless owners who they were required to pay them at this point, but these black codes were developed, and it wasn't an easy time. This whole process was very slow, coming into the whole arena of being free from slavery. It's not something that just occurred overnight. And of course, we had behind the scenes, Frederick Douglass, and then we had Thaddeus Stevens and Charles Sumner with the Radical Republicans in Congress, constantly trying to reiterate, the new Confederate existence and having the South adjust to, coming into the Union. And there wasn't only the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments. You had the Ku Klux Klan Act of 1871 that tried to eliminate the activity of the Ku Klux Klan. You had the Freedmen's Bureau Act. The process was slow and challenging. And, of course, when blacks who come out of slavery and who are existing, trying to find a way of existence during the Reconstruction period, started to somewhat get adjusted. And here we came with 1896, the Plessy versus Ferguson Act, which really kind of justified segregation as separate but equal. And so it was not an easy process.
Thank you very much. I don't want to. I guess other people have questions too, but I want to ask one more quick question. I don't want to hog it up. I know you're tired.
Okay.
I asked a question to Dr. Myers the other day. I didn't get a chance to drive it home. Okay, the Juneteenth thing was about how blacks didn't find out too later on that they were freed and people are celebrating. Okay, I was just looking at the whole question of the Star Spangled Banner. I had to bring that in to show that every time you watch TV, we're singing Star Spangled Banner, Marvin Gaye, Aretha Franklin, they're all singing the Star Spangled Banner, right? Okay. That's in 1812 sometime around there somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, this came about, right, with Francis, what was his name again? Francis something. So why would we sing, if we're going to go through this whole thing about, we're not going to celebrate the normal thing about independence like white people do, we're going to celebrate our own independence. Okay, so then if that would be go, we're going to follow through and make it, consistent, then we don't have to really basically sing the Star Spangled Banner because we were deep in slavery in 1812, right? And so why would we sing something that has nothing to do with us too during the 1812 war if it came about, right? Why don't we just start step by step, just breaking free from all those holidays. Mm-hmm. All those holidays had nothing to do with us. Mm-hmm. All those songs had nothing to do with us. Like, Star Spangled Banner has nothing to do with black people. Mm-hmm. It has something to do with the white folks.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, I think that idea is very clear. It is just like Thomas Jefferson and the Bill of Rights, that all men are created equal, and blacks were chattel, and that didn't really apply to them. I mean, these ideas are strong ideas, that we shouldn't celebrate. But there's one thing that is unique and that we need to give some concentration to, and that is all of these events are somewhat constitutional in an imperfect society. And we don't live in a pure democracy. Democracy is still an experiment. And I think that is, I kind of wondered myself when my grandfather was with the 369th Regiment in the First World War and mm-hmm. had an uncle in the Second World War. And I said, why? And my grandfather came out of Ozark, Alabama. And I said, why would he go and fight for the freedom of a country when, his father was a slave in Alabama and he was segregated against. And I think he had this notion of a newness, and not a conclusion of things. If laws were penal code laws, then we can strike out and use this kind of argument that, okay, we weren't a part of this, so we shouldn't celebrate it. But there's one vision that I think the even though we had a number of signers of the American Constitution who owned slaves themselves, and that was including Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, etc. There was, even Thomas Jefferson realized that even though he, now he owned 150 slaves in 1810, and this was even after he served as President of the United States. But even he realized that, listen, this thing is not going to work, this in the future, if there is, if America is going to continue. And therefore, the words that, even the words that he wrote, have to be justified and changed with a an addendum process in the Constitution, adding on of new laws and rules with every new Congress and Supreme, you know, and Supreme Court and President. That the whole idea of a Constitution and what might be a democracy had to have an addendum to it, a back door to it, where you add on the rights. And this is why, you know, there, the 13th and 14th and 15th Amendments were added on to what appeared to be a very conservative document. And the practices tended to be, you know, with every period that we saw during the 19th century and going into the, you know, the early 20th century, and all the difficulty that we've had with race in America, that as long as there's this sense of addendum and changing of process and adding on something stronger and language that can be passed into law that is stronger than what was there before, there might be a sense of hope that one day we might form a true democracy focused around freedom, justice, and equality. And one of the great tragedies of this is we say, well, what, we don't have to do this here. Let us return to, you know, in let us return to some place in Africa. And when we look at that, when we look at African nations and places like South Africa that's coming out of almost a similar experience, and the struggle that we see going on all over the continent, you know, colonialism had as great an impact on that continent as slavery had on blacks in America. And so this question is one that is, it is in one sense academic, but there's a reality to it, that we celebrate freedom when we can, but we also have to have this hope that we can make not only this nation but this world a better place, that we can make Africa a better place to live and the Caribbean a better place to live, and the, we can go back and really say that we're returning home. But America is still an experiment, and that is the real challenge. It is still an experiment. We look at why the blacks go and why we have young black men and women fighting now in Iran and Afghanistan, is because, you know, this sense that we're trying to move towards something that is new and different. That is not necessarily integration, but equality and justice and freedom for all. And so that's why, you know, when you see people who have, and of course people in Texas are still being discriminated against in areas, but this idea of hope that let's celebrate those, you know, that event on and events like it that gives us a sense and a vision and the possibility of justice and freedom and equality, and not give up on it. And let's just take an event where we were free and didn't know we were free through the Emancipation Proclamation, but we became, when we were known of the fact, let's celebrate that, you see. And so that's, it's a confusing kind of thing but it is something that we need to keep before us as an ideal, and not give up hope, because the other route, the conclusion is clear. We can move into a period of isolation, and we can even talk about reconnection with Africa. But Africa is right now is kind of in a confused state all over the continent, with its politics and its leadership and so on. And we would have to go over there to help straighten things out if we have a vision of progress. But I would always like to believe, and I'm looking at Frantz Fanon, you know, and his Black Skins and White Mask and other works, is that, well, you know, ultimately, these concepts like of freedom and justice and equality are intrinsic. They're internal. They're inside out. If you look at them outside in, there is always a state of confusion. And I think that we need to strive hard and continue to strive towards those things that our foreparents and that slave fought for, to make an adjustment. Not necessarily, you can't change someone else's conscience, but you certainly can change your own conscience and really be an example and give I do believe that the Black man in America has an opportunity to show the white American and the world what a true democracy means. And that's what we need to keep on course. That you know, we went through slavery and we went through segregation and discrimination, and we know what that is. But we also have a sense of what freedom really means and equality really means, and we need to focus on that and make this a better world.
Thank you, Dr. Bessel. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think that it was the hope that we had as enslaved people that gives us the right to celebrate these different holidays and these
sure.
songs.
Sure.
It's the hope, you know.
That's right.
We were celebrating before these holidays even existed.
Exactly.
So for one to say that we should not acknowledge these holidays as ours, we were the first ones to even come up with the concept of the holiday
right.
and the songs.
Right.
So I don't think it's devaluing our experience by saying that.
Right.
We
should never forget,
no.
you know, the experiences that our great-grandparents and certainly my grandfather was the son of a slave and on both sides. From Ozark, Alabama, and the other coming out of the Caribbean, and both of them were lost their lives trying to stand up for freedom, you know, out of slavery. But it is something that I talk about in my family as a form of celebration, that these were brave men, and there were brave women in the family, and they went through a lot that you and I can't even begin to articulate, but we can't give up hope. We have something that is meaningful and has a purpose and vision to it, and we need to celebrate our past. We need to take the positive things that have come out of slavery and celebrate them, and not give up on them, and let the world know that we have some answers to what human progress means.
Oh, that's beautiful. Well, thank you for listening to Dr. Bethel of Rutgers University. I hope you really enjoyed his talk on Juneteenth. He was responding to Dr. Metters of the University of William Patterson in Wayne, New Jersey. Dr. Metters is a person who doesn't believe blacks, African Americans, should celebrate American holidays which existed while we were enslaved. So he also posed this very same question to another guest we had on our show earlier in the week, Dr. Myers. Dr. Myers is a activist, a medical doctor as well, and a jazz musician who, since 1994, has made it his mission to have Juneteenth ratified as a national holiday. So far, he has helped 31 different states ratify Juneteenth as a state holiday. So let's listen to a clip of Dr. Myers and Dr. Metters exchanging ideas and words about Juneteenth and who should celebrate it and why we shouldn't celebrate it. All right, thanks for listening.
Yeah. Well, it's an honor for me to be on the this kind of a forum to discuss a very important history and legacy of our people, Juneteenth.
Okay. All right, could you explain what Juneteenth is?
Well, Juneteenth is really short for the 19th of June. It was June 19th, 1865, when a Union general by the name of Gordon Granger landed in Galveston, Texas, the last geographic area of this country where slavery was still practiced, to make the announcement that they were all free by actions of Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, signed over 2.5 years earlier. It took over 2.5 years for the news on June 19, 1865, when the Union General Gordon Granger landed to make the announcement that all the slaves were free. This is more than 2.5 years after the Emancipation Proclamation went into effect. Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation September 22, 1863, for the slave states, or the southern states that remain in rebellion, if they did not stop their rebellion on January 1st, 1863. I got some interference going on. Okay, that's better. Yeah, on January 1st, 1863, if the southern states remained in rebellion, all their slaves would be free. So the Emancipation Proclamation stated those states and territories and areas that the slaves would be freed. And Galveston, Texas, where that announcement was made, on the 19th of June, 1865. And so our ancestors celebrated over 145 years ago, and we continue to honor our ancestors by joining them in the celebration of the announcement of freedom on June 19, 1865. And I'm working with Juneteenth organizations and celebrations to establish the 19th of June, Juneteenth Independence Day, as a commemoration of the end of slavery. We have 31 states now that recognize Juneteenth as a state holiday or a state holiday observance, special day of recognition, Kansas being the last state. And several weeks ago, thanks to State Senator David Haley, the great nephew of Alice Haley, we have 31 states, and we also have been recognized by the Congress of the United States for the first time in 1997. Through legislation sponsored by Trent Lott and J.C. Watts in the House, and recognized the 19th of June, Juneteenth, as Juneteenth Independence of America. And so we're continuing to work through the National Juneteenth Holiday Campaign.
Okay. Now, you were saying that the Congress recognizes as America's Independence Day. Did I hear you correctly?
Well, no. In 1997, first of all, the first efforts to recognized Juneteenth nationally as a day of independence for African Americans was officially passed in 1997, Senate Joint Resolution 11, House Joint Resolution 56, recognizing the 19th of June, Juneteenth Independence Day in America. And we have we have 31 states now to officially recognize Juneteenth as a state holiday, beginning in Texas in 1980, state holiday observance. And now we have 31 states. And so we're still working to have Juneteenth recognized in the rest of the 19 states, and also to have a national day of observance for Juneteenth and the end of slavery on the 19th of June, Juneteenth Independence Day.
All right. That was Dr. Myers of Mississippi. He is a lobbyist for the holiday Juneteenth Day. And I hope you enjoyed his clip. And he explained how he worked diligently to have Juneteenth ratified in 31 states since 1994. We can continue on with the clip, I think, which is very profound. A clip between Dr. Metters and Dr. Bethel of Rutgers University. Dr. Metters is a professor in African studies at William Patterson University, and he is part of a program, whereas Dr. Bethel is a professor at Rutgers University, and he is part of a department, and there's a difference. The department offers degrees, while a program offers elective courses, okay? So Dr. Metters is asking Dr. Bethel for advice on how to form a department at the University of William Patterson in Wayne, New Jersey. So listen to this exchange. I think you will enjoy it.
What do you feel about the whole question, like William Patterson University? In order to graduate from William Patterson University, the only two history courses that you have to take is Western Civilization and the Western the World, 101 and 102, and that's it. You can graduate from William Patterson University without taking one course in civil rights or American slavery or anything of that nature. So sometimes I look at it as like an institutional problem. Right, an institutional problem where hundreds and hundreds or thousands and thousands of people graduate from school without even taking a course in civil rights.
Have they been approached on it as a question?
Yes, they've been approached on it. We're generally elected. We're in right now. We're trying to figure out what courses that they should be compelled to take. Some people have some different forces that they should just be able to take whatever they want to take. And so usually whatever they do with whatever they want to take, they don't take those courses. We have a small African American, program here, but that's not really blossoming as it should be. But I teach civil rights and American slavery, and I get a lot of people, but most of those people here seem to be white folks, white kids. I mean, I get a number of black people, but I don't think I get enough black kids. I don't think that one, and in my eyes, I don't think that one black should graduate from a college without taking a basic course in civil rights and American slavery. I don't see how you can survive. And so, out there intellectually. So, and on top of that, we have another program that we had that was almost like embarrassing. The N word. We had to have every semester we have what we call a workshop on the N word because the word nigger was being used so loosely. Like it's almost embarrassing. I said, what is this word nigger every time it's coming out of your mouth? So we had to have a word for that. So we do have a different type of youth this time. We have a different type of task in front of us in dealing with the students now in the year 2009. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, that's when you pass. I don't know about the Rutgers and Philly Dickinson, things like that. But, it's a tragic when a kid comes out there and don't know nothing about Rosa Parks, Emmett Till, Frederick Douglass. I never read Malcolm X. I never read the book. Nothing. So how are you going to get call yourself a college grad and haven't even read that, the basics?
Right.
So that's just like, I'm not talking about community. I'm talking about institutionally.
Right.
Institutionally, we don't control these institutions, but we have to muscle them to make them take these basic courses. Western Civ, okay, that's important. Western World, okay, that's important, maybe. But I just can't see that you can come out of the school and know nothing about Plessy Ferguson and Brown versus Board, Board of Education. You don't know it.
There are ways that, you can, it's not an easy process, but see what's wrong with the African-American program you have there. I know something about it, and I know with the passing of the chair, the program kind of disseminated.
Von Paris.
Someone has to get together and find out, why the program is weak and what should happen to improve the program. That's on one side. Another is that to meet with the students and see why they see if they can organize into some African American collective or black collective, and have constant programs with speakers coming in and enlightening and so on until the department program. Is it a program or a department?
It's a program.
Seeing that that has to be built up so that it can become a discipline, a legitimate department.
But he won't even hire people.
With majors. So.
Okay, we're going to go to the last clip where Dr. Bethel is going to continue to explain to Dr. Metters on how to get a program started, Africana program started at William Patterson.
Well, all of this emerged after the assassination of Martin Luther King in 1968 when Martin King was assassinated and things just exploded around the country, protest and this kind of thing, and many of the predominantly white institutions decided to open up their doors. You know, and the young people were protesting. And of course, there was protesting throughout the 60s. The Martin Luther King movement, then the Black Power movement came on the scene, and then Malcolm X and his protest, and all of that was coming to a head. But when Martin King was assassinated, that kind of sparked up everything. And the students began, the few black students who were in the predominantly white universities, they began to raise questions and protest, and then they began to take a look at, the possibility of bringing in students that they'd never brought in before into these schools, into a Rutgers and even Princeton and Harvard and University of Wisconsin and Ohio State University, all across the country. The South hadn't opened up. The segregation was still in flow as far as opening, admitting many black students to their schools. The Civil Rights Act did tear down segregation, but the process was slow, like University of Georgia and University of South Carolina and so on. But in many of the schools in the Northeast began to open up their doors. And now Rutgers started in 1968-69. They started what was called an urban university program. And I came in 1969 with that. And then they had a transitional year program, which had more than 400 or 500 black students. And it was an experiment, and the few of us who were there, we had to work overtime. We had to make this thing work, and it took a lot of dedication, a lot of hours, and to do all that we had to do. And the Urban University Program, we set up, we had a special faculty to deal with these students and getting them to transition into the regular curriculum. And it just took a lot of hard work. We didn't know whether it was going to last or not, or whether it would end. And, of course, back then there was support from the Office of Economic Opportunity out of Washington, D.C. There was some funding for the students, and we knew that that wouldn't last. And so we had to make sure that we would set up a structure that would bring African-American students in on a traditional basis and to fit into the program. And so we worked hard towards that, and the students helped us. And we did have, I must admit, there were some very bright African-American students back then, and most of them are real significant contributors to society now, doctors and lawyers and PhDs and really smart young people who helped us with who had these organizations, the Black Women's Organization and the Black Men's Organizations and the African, you know what I mean? I can't tell the whole story in one conversation, but I can say that it took a lot of work and dedication and vision and setting up a policy that you want fulfilled, an academic vision, an academic policy that you try to live by, making sure that the courses were well organized had a specific purpose with specific reading materials, and make sure that it was academic with exams and research papers and so on. And we made it work. That's the bottom line.
I have a quick question, Dr. Bethel. Now, I know you said in 54, the Brown versus Topeka, Kansas, and also the 70s riots and the deaths of black leaders had an effect on these colleges allowing enrollments of black students.
Right.
Did it have a negative effect on the historically black schools? And I'm going to say this because in New Jersey there is a school, a former school called the Manual Training Institute, and I'm only abbreviating it. It's in Bordentown. It's now a juvenile detention center. Originally, it was founded by an ex-slave, a minister by the name of Reverend Rice from South Carolina.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
It was based on Booker T. Washington's model, Tuskegee.
Yes.
And as a result of the 54 case, Brown versus the Board of Education, the school was closed.
I see.
And I was wondering, you know, if a lot of black schools also had the same, met the same demise as Bordentown School in New Jersey as a result of predominantly white colleges allowing African American
students. Well, you know, there were many failures along with progress. And, for example, there were four private schools for blacks in the state of New Jersey, and all of them closed down.
I didn't know that. Go ahead.
I need to take time to do this, you know, but someone can do it. It's research out these schools and the names and you know, who was involved in the curriculum and that kind of thing. One of the noted black secondary schools, the Boggs Academy down in Georgia, they sent 99.9% of those kids on to colleges around the country. It closed down. I know Felicia Rashad, you know, was interested in rejuvenating, and it was run by the Presbyterian Church. This is going to happen. The schools are going to, with the integrative process, black schools will suffer and have suffered. But there's still a place for the schools, and one of the things that we're beginning to see, and is interesting, I'm looking at, and I served on the Board of Trustees at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, I took part in the process of being a board member, adding on graduate programs. We added on four master's programs, and also we began to see that there were white students in the area, not far from the campus, who began to come there. They tend not to stay overnight, but they came and took classes and then enrolled. But without the curriculum and the focus changing for, you know, seeing that black students get proper education and vision and direction and so on. There are schools that are up against a challenge financially because of integration. We see this. At one time, the black colleges attracted the top black athletes in the country out of high school. But that's not, the predominantly white schools are grabbing them up with scholarship money and that kind of thing, and black schools have lost out. But nevertheless,
I'd like to take you back to the day that you decided to leave Lincoln and go to Rutgers.
Could
you just give us a synopsis of?
Well,
you know,
there were two things happening. It wasn't so much of my leaving. I have actually, there was a letter. Marvin Wachman was president of Lincoln University, and he went on and became president of Temple University. He is now deceased. a letter went in to him for me to come back to Lincoln and become chaplain, and that other things unfolded. I had an opportunity to study again. I earned my doctorate from Rutgers. I earned a second master's a master's of arts in theology, and I had a master's of divinity when I was at Lincoln University. I had an opportunity to go on and study at Rutgers, and it was an exciting time because they approached me because there weren't that many of us who had the training in dealing with identified black students who would not ordinarily go into a four-year program. And they had these 300 students that they had admitted with letters of support and reference, and not necessarily SAT scores back then. And they needed a staff to guide them and help them fit in. The traditional staff there didn't feel equipped to do it. And so with my the extra training that I got at Tufts University in Atlanta and dealing with these students, I was one of the few people and all the people who came along with me, we got jobs all around the country in these predominantly white universities to help with these black students. And that's what took me to Rutgers in 1969. I really wasn't planning to stay. I said, well, I'm going to earn my master's and my doctorate, and I'll return to Lincoln. But
we started
this program in Africana, and I didn't. And the chaplain came. When I earned my doctorate, the chaplain came, and he, at the graduation, he says, Bethel, I see some things happening, and you're needed here. I know we would love to have you back. And he says, stay here and get this thing developed. This seems interesting, this African and African-American studies and so on, because they didn't even have, they inculcated those courses in the history department at Lincoln, but they didn't have a separate department, and I think they were interested in seeing at Lincoln and other black colleges how these special areas would work, especially in predominantly white schools. So I was encouraged to stay, and I did. And I didn't know there was. And then when we got into all the hard work and making the thing work, I didn't have much time to think about much else. I had a young family, and I didn't want to deny my children, and anyway, one thing led to another, and 40 years have passed.
I think you've done an exceptional job. I think you chose the right decision to go to Rutgers, and it seems as though that you really never left Lincoln, because you said that you're still chairing, or
No, I was on the board of trustees for two terms, 8 years. And I keep in contact, and very much interested in its development. And I'm an alum of Lincoln.
Right.
And I was co-captain of the last football. Now, Lincoln has had football return. Last year was the first season. But I was co-captain at the last Howard Lincoln game in the fall of 1960. And lo and behold, last year when they opened up their first game, I was one of the few people who went out with the cheerleaders right out. They took me out to the center of the field, and I was just excited, you know, return of football. And I just have, you know, this attachment, and I go out often, and I had a pep talk with the football team, and told them that, you know, that victory is spirit, and that kind of thing. And so I keep my contact, and I know that progress is universal, and we have to make this thing work everywhere.
Right.
And that's why I didn't give up on Rutgers. There's some fine young African-Americans who've come out of Rutgers, and I'm so happy that I taught them, who are making a contribution around the country.
Mr. Price, are you familiar with...
Clement Price?
Yes,
I know him very well. Yeah, he teaches. He's the African American historian for the state. He's over at the Newark campus. Yeah, he's a real brilliant scholar, and he knows more about these black towns. than anybody else. He and Giles Wright, they are the experts on this. There were seven or eight black towns in New Jersey, all black towns. One of them, this fellow Stedman, who was dating Oprah Winfrey,
right.
He was born and raised in one of those towns, you know, and he gave money back to help the town survive. And if you want to talk about those towns, you talk to Giles Clem Price. So he's the expert on that.
Do you know Giles Wright passed away?
When did he pass?
He passed away maybe around 3 months ago.
I knew he was sick.
Yes, he did pass.
I didn't know he actually passed.
Yes.
He did actually pass. Oh, my. I was reaching out to him in the hospital. I didn't know he... I guess he had cancer? Or?
I didn't get the details, but I was in the middle of a talk at Bordentown, in Bordentown's library, when someone showed me the obituary in the newspaper.
Oh.
That's how I found out. But
well, you know, he's written a very interesting book on these towns. I have it somewhere in my collection here, and you know, it's something that a lot of our folks don't know about that we had. Now, no one, let me say this, and this is my colleague at William Patterson.
Yes.
No one has written about these black schools that were here in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a challenge for someone.
Right.
You know?
We'll work with you, won't we, Dr. Metters?
No, I can't agree with you.
Know,
work, but
we
you know, his
schools
yeah.
here. And
yeah.
That's something.
That's what I was trying to say. You took the words out of my mouth. You know, it's totally interesting.
You know, that's an open field.
Yes.
You know, it's an open field. Another thing, we have slaves buried in this state, and we don't even know where the burial sites are, and that's another challenge.
Right.
But